This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. While attending the recent Magic Live convention here in May of 2022, I found time to sit down with Master Payne and talk with him. He was the first presenter, actually, in the general session and was a great way of opening the convention because his PowerPoint presentations he's given in the past just knock it out of the park. They're so creative, they're very entertaining, and educational to a degree as well. And this week, we get a chance to talk with him about how he developed that routine or those PowerPoints and how he came to the attention of Stan Allen, and because he also is an instructor at Jeff McBride's Magic and Mystery School. So he has a lot to teach us, certainly. Jeff certainly thinks so, and so therefore I think I agree with Jeff. You should listen to what Payne has to say. And I say Payne because his name is Master Payne Feifeld, and he goes by Master Payne, and he'll talk a little bit about that, about how that came about. And also, I have had several people in the past who have either emailed me or talked to me and said, you need to do an episode with Master Payne. Well, we have sat down and talked on several occasions for content when I'm at a magic convention for daily updates, but I've never really had the chance to sit down. Well, before the convention actually began on Sunday, we spoke on Sunday morning in my room, so we had a chance, just the two of us, to be uninterrupted and spend some quality time. And I can't believe how quickly the time went when I just glanced at my watch, and it was just a little over an hour. So he has a lot to say, and so I'm going to quit saying what I'm saying so you can enjoy what he has to say right now. Please welcome my guest and my good friend, Master Payne, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me someone who has actually been a requested person by some of the listeners of saying, hey, can you get this guy on your podcast sometime? And I said, I have had him here actually before, just in bits and pieces. My friend, Master Payne, you're going to be hearing here in just a moment, has actually been on the podcast from time to time when we're Magic Live, and also he was a speaker at the Texas Association of Magicians Convention some time ago. But actually, this is the first time we've had a chance to actually sit down and enjoy a full hour of conversation between the two of us. And I'm really looking forward to this because he has so much to offer, and I know you're going to love it as much as I do. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Master Payne.
Mr. Master Payne.
Yes. Mr. Master.
Yes.
Just Master.
Just Master.
Or yes, Mr. Master. Payne. But your name is Feifeld?
Feifeld. My given name, legal name, is Feifeld. It's F-I-F-I-E-L-D. That I've really, never liked it even as a kid because it's impossible to spell. The people ask, is that with a P-H? Yeah, P-H-Y-P-H-Y. No. Or they spell, you say it's Feifeld and they go field? No, Feifeld. And then you spell out F-I-F-I-E-L-D and they go field? No, I'm not stuttering. So any chance to abandon the name, and it doesn't even sound magical. I never even used it as a kid when I was performing because I'm going, you have the amazing Feifeld. No, it just doesn't sound good. So.
Well, do you have a middle name?
Payne. Payne is actually my middle name.
Oh, really? That's kind of like Lance Burton. Lance, that's his middle name, actually.
Yeah.
So what is your first name?
Oh, I it's James, which is a name I also hate because nobody can pronounce it. Because you go and they go, hi, my name's Jim. Oh, hello, Jim. How did I say Jim?
Yeah.
No, and I hate the name Jim. I just really, really hate it. And so when I started just to use Payne, they usually go, what? They go, Payne. Pawn? No, Payne.
Yeah, what did I just say?
They don't go, oh, hi, Pay, or hi, Pa. No, okay. they just go Payne. So.
What if you just hit him in the arm with, real hard?
So yeah.
What do you feel? I feel pain.
No, well, I have to go like Thomas Payne, but it's the first name, not a last name.
Yes.
So it's...
Man with two last names.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Well, I understand. There's so many people, again, who are Richard or James or whatever, and you just call them naturally, or Henry goes by Hank or whatever.
Yeah, and
Well, so the name Master, obviously, is something that you acquired in later life when you're doing, like, Renfest and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no, it was actually... the Society for Creative Anachronism, known as the SCA, which I was involved in many years ago, which is actually where I adopted the name Payne because it wasn't my given name. I legally changed it. my middle name, which was Earl, which was my grandfather's name, but Earl is just a horrible name, and you know, I need to own a pickup truck and a farmer's hat, you know? And so
a MAGA hat.
So in the society, you're supposed to adopt a medieval persona. So I stumbled across this old ancient family member from the 12th century named Payne of Wood Rising, and I'm going, oh, I kind of like that. So I chose the name Payne, and everybody just knows you by your medieval name. So when I moved from my hometown of Yakima to Seattle, the only friends I had were in the society, and so they just called me Payne, and so it just stuck. So I just said it. So when I got married, I changed it legally to Payne. And so in this society, the highest arts award you can get is called a laurel, and I received a laurel for doing magic, and that gives you the title of a master. And so I used Master Payne mainly for Renaissance fairs and medieval fairs and things, and as well as the SCA. And then when I was hired to do Magic Live back in 2011, you know, they had the big, you know, screens that have your names on it. And Stan said, what name do you want? And I said, Payne. And he said, no, I don't like to have a single name.
Names. I mean, share.
People. Teller. I said, have you ever had Teller? Teller speak here? What did you call him? Mr. Teller? And so he said, well, I need something. And so I said, screw it. I'll just go with Master Payne. And which they screwed up because the guy put Major Payne instead of Master Payne.
There's a big difference there.
Big difference there. But because I was, you know, the 2011 Magic Live was sort of my introduction to the magic community at large, because I, you know, didn't have any kind of recognition outside of the Seattle area and barely any recognition there. But,
well, that would get to me a point of how you got that kind of national recognition. In other words, did someone see you there and suggest that to Stan, or was Stan and Alan up in the area?
No. These talks that I do were all created for the Magic and Mystery School that Jeff McBride holds here in Las Vegas. And I had a friend that spent years, you know, saying, oh, you got to go to these. And I'm going, yeah, it's not really my thing. I'm not into the spiritual aspect of magic, even though that's just only a section of the conferences. But he finally talked me into it. And I had met Jeff in passing a few times. And once he found out I was going, he said, you've got to talk here, because they kind of have this collective that the people that attend the conference also speak at it.
Right.
And so he's going, you need to speak at this. And I'm going, I really don't want to speak at this. And I'd like to go to one to kind of get a feeling for the room. And no, I want you to speak at it. And, and it finally wore me down. And I said, okay, I'll talk at it. But a year or two previously, I had done spoken at a convention, and the guy ahead of me had basically covered every topic I was going to cover. And so I had to sort of make it up on the fly, and it just was like horrible. So I said, I need something that will make me stick to a script that I can't deviate from. And if somebody covers the same topics, I'll just cover them better. And so I said, PowerPoint, and we'll do a PowerPoint, and this will keep me cemented to the script. And so I developed this fairly acerbic, tongue-in-cheek PowerPoint presentation called Why Do We Repeat Ourselves? Which is basically, why do magicians use the patter that comes with the trick?
Mm-hmm.
And it was primitive by my standards now. It only had like 40 or 50 slides. I'm now upwards of usually over 100.
Wow. And how long? Like a 20-minute talk?
20-minute talk.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to speak on the third day of this conference. So I sit there and I'm watching all these people talk about Vedic circles and chakras. And I'm just sitting here going, oh, I'm just going to die.
These people are reading up that kind of stuff.
And here I have this kind of acerbic, you know, thing. And I'm sort of looking at where the exits are and thinking that really nobody knows who I am.
Yeah.
And I can just slink off in shame, and no one will ever hear from me again. But it was just the opposite. It was the perfect release for a really, you know, kind of, you know, tense and serious conference. And it got this like standing ovation by all 30 people in the room. Yeah. But as I'm putting my stuff away, I hear somebody's hugging me, and I turn around, and it's Eugene Berger going, "That is one of the best presentations I've ever seen."
Very well. Well,
that's high praise indeed. And so I got invited back the next year, and you know, like Harry Anderson said, your first magic special, you plan your entire life planning for. Your second magic special, you plan 6 months because, you know, I've used all my best material for the first one. So, but they covered a wide variety of subjects, and each one, you know, went over equally well. And I became the official closing speaker at the conference because nobody wanted to follow me. Mm-hmm. And Jeff just became a big fan, and so he pitched me to Stan for me to go on here.
And, right. You
know, and a big chance, because I designed these for a fairly esoteric magic conference, so there was the perfect chance of just walking out on the stage and falling flat on my face, because people would be going, "What the hell is he talking about?"
You have quite a cross-section of registrants, attendees, I should say,
But it went over very well, and I kind of hit the ground running, because people are like going, "Who is this guy? He's obviously done this before.
Right.
Why have we never seen this guy?"
Right.
Which then got me an article written about me in the Magic magazine,
years ago.
Years ago, when it was still a magazine. And
before it was a convention. Well, it was a convention.
No, it was a convention. And then that article led me to actually write a column for like 18 months. Which I'm totally unexpected how, you know, that I would be writing. I mean, the first thought that entered my mind when Stan asked me to write a column, I'm going, really, is it come to that? Are we completely out of people to write magic columns? So I actually
and you had no writing experience prior to that, I guess.
Oh,
not for
much.
Magazines or anything.
I had written some articles for like the electronic grimoire, mm-hmm. You know, just
I remember the EG.
Just patter, you know, and things. And both Larry White kind of encouraged me that I should write more.
Sure.
And I've been writing reviews for Mum for a few years by that, but you know, that's just reviews. That's not, you know, I don't have any, you know, serious writing mm-hmm. abilities, but I guess I tend to write better than most, according to the people who edit me.
Do you write with a stream of consciousness and then go back and edit, or you just kind of
throw it out and let it
see
go.
Where it lands? Okay.
Yeah. When I construct the PowerPoint presentations, I kind of come up with an idea, and then I write, you know, a third of it sort of, and then sort of start assembling the slideshows to go with it, because sometimes you'll hit a graphic that'll just steer you in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
And then you spend a lot of time developing the punchline, and there's still a few that don't have as good of punchlines as I want, but in each presentation takes weeks to mm-hmm. put together, and I think that was the thing that surprised me the most about the first Magic Live I went to, is I was watching the general sessions and going, wow, there's so many of us that are just really bad at public speaking, which is, I'm going, this is, you know, this is what we do. But there's a difference between doing a show and actually doing a public speaking type gig. And I'm mm-hmm. like, but I'm just sort of going, wow, this is sort of eye-opening. But again, you know, a lot, you know, Magic Live doesn't pay that well, so it doesn't it's not worthwhile for people to spend 6 weeks building a thing. But since I already had them done mostly for the Magic and Meaning conference,
right,
which pays nothing, so but it's just I'm kind of manic depressive about that, and I know my wife hates these because all of my attention is focused elsewhere for like, you know, a month and while I put these things together.
Is there something occasionally that will trigger your fancy? I mean, I remember a few years ago when you put the one together about I don't know, it was the 10-cent something or other that was a trick, and it was an ad in a magazine, and
that was the only time I was able to actually to perform a magic trick at Magic Live, and that's my coin and bottle.
That was it, coin and bottle,
which is the world's longest coin and bottle trick, which is, you know, 15 minutes long, and I only put the coin in the bottle once, and that was basically inspired I think it was even here in Vegas. I went to the Coca-Cola store and they had these giant Coke bottles.
Right.
And I thought, oh, that'd be funny just to sort of throw a bit of the coin in bottle and you just drop a regular 50-cent piece into the bottle. and but I didn't buy the bottle. It just sort of mulled over the back of my head. And then I found them in glass. The ones at the Coke store are plastic. And that'd be great. But it was like $60. And I go, $60 is too much for a single. So I just sort of, you know, bought it, and the routine basically wrote itself. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that I had a two-phase routine with putting a small coin in a regular bottle and then in the end of the regular coin in a big bottle. And I needed a third phase to, you know, link, and that was what caused me the most problems. And I finally decided to go with, putting a coin into a plastic bottle, because at the time there was really no such things. But I did actually find a real vintage plastic Coke bottle to use for that portion of the demonstration. So that was that one really kind of wrote itself.
A rubber coin in a rubber bottle would have.
I had seen these rubber mayonnaise bottles.
Yeah.
But I couldn't find them. I can't even think of what.
Was this before Nielsen was making these
bottles? No. The Nielsen bottles are too good.
Okay.
The rubber bottle has to be look ludicrous.
Rubber.
And these it's a squeezable mayonnaise, I think called Kewpie or something, but I couldn't find any because it just had to be stupid looking. So, but striking on the idea of a plastic bottle with a very visible hole in the back was what I finally went with, and gave me the line about we'd never seen these before, and very few people did because they didn't stay on the market long because they outgassed like crazy, which is true. That's why they went off the market. But but they were on the market long enough for someone to figure out a way to use them to rub the hard-earned money from the grass-stained hands of little boys, which is so true. Just growing up in the 60s and 70s,
yes,
just you'd order this thing out of the catalog and you'd go, it's a piece of tinfoil and a rubber band and half of a tongue depressor, and I spent $7 on this thing.
It's like X-ray glasses.
Or the flashing eyes where you would just glue foil to your eyelids, you know.
Yeah.
And they're going, really? smoke from fingers. You know
you rub your fingers
and together, and you get those strands, smoke. And then your hand was covered with probably what is highly carcinogenic sort.
I had that as a kid.
It used to be the standard thing in the magic kits, and you don't see it anymore. It's like fizzies. You don't see those anymore. What were they made of? And I'm going to die of some horrible disease because they had to take there's asbestos in fizzies.
And now we know.
Damn.
I remember ordering once the floating light bulb for, I think it was $6 or $10. And when I got it, it was an aluminum tray and a light bulb, and it said, fill tray with water.
Yeah, the thing that would get me is like floating ball, and you get the floating ball, and it says attach the thread. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So the next floating ball uses no thread. Oh, okay, I'll get this.
Yeah.
Attach string. You floating ball uses no string or thread. You get it. Attach wire. So that's really what the whole coin and bottle routine was based on, is really learning how to read catalog ads.
Yeah.
Because yeah, really, you know, okay, it doesn't say thread.
The partial truths.
Yeah, there's these, it's sort of like all the YouTube demos now that, look, it does this. Yeah, it does that, but how do you get into that and how do you get out of that?
Right.
You know, there's so much going, yeah, this looks really good, but only from this angle. So I don't think I can convince my audience to shut one eye through the entire presentation.
I saw a picture or meme one time in which there was a row of folding chairs. There was just back to back to back. I mean, there weren't two, we were just one row, one chair behind another chair, basically like six deep. And they said, this is how your audience should set for all these sans minds tricks.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the Balducci levitation. Looks good for the one guy, you know. When somebody first showed it to me, I went, you're kidding, right? Really?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But, you know, and the problem is, it's the Balducci and like healed and sealed. two of the world's worst tricks.
Except for
when you do them in the right situation,
correct,
then they're miracles. But I'm going, healed and sealed just doesn't work in a show. Oh, look, I have a can. Now it's full.
Right.
No, it works at a picnic where you just rummage through the garbage and you pick it up.
Correct.
And that's the only, you don't follow it with other tricks.
Yeah.
You don't even say, you just do it. And people will remember that forever. But if it's part of a show, it just becomes another trick.
Well, I heard in a recent podcast somebody saying that Muhammad Ali had done the Balducci rise, and it fooled people, I guess, who were close by or in the right angle.
Yeah, yeah. But it didn't matter because then he would tell them how they did it.
That's true, too. That's what he did.
Yeah, that's what Muhammad Ali did. But you know, then there was that whole self-levitation craze.
Right.
And everybody and his brother coming out with even worse and worse and worse methods for it. And, you know, and just completely destroying the fact that this is an impromptu thing that you do in the right situation, hopefully a hallway, mm-hmm, where it's a miracle and you don't have to have all this other crap. But, and then they started pre-selling and we'll just hype this and then get all the money and then we'll send it out. And then
do you think it's better or worse today than Master? Should I call you MP or Master? Or what do you prefer? What do people call you? Just Pain?
Pain.
Okay, Pain. So do you think it's better or worse today as far as advertising goes? Do you think they are trying to hype things better? I personally think they tend to hype things more because you have different ways of doing it with these videos and everything of going out in the audience, and you see people like here on the Strip in Vegas that are just going over the top crazy when you see something. You
know? Yeah. Well, it's also I've always wanted to make a commercial for optional camera crew that comes with whatever trick you buy to increase your reactions, because you know you just do this thing and people just sit there, but do it with a camera crew and suddenly you go, oh my god, that's the best thing ever.
That's a very good
because
point.
I'm going to be on TV, so if I don't act like I'm crazy, I won't get on TV.
Did you ever do one of the LNL videos?
No, I never had the
those audiences were like that.
Yeah,
when I'd work with Banachek and we had done the Psy series many years ago, I was warming up the audience with a couple of things, and I've never gotten that kind of reaction from anybody before nor since. And it's kind of like, there are cameras, and they're going to be on video, and that's just an overreaction.
Well, also, it's probably that did they get fed, or was there?
Yeah, they get fed.
Yeah, so they know if they don't react, even if it wasn't cameras, if they don't, they're not getting invited back, so they don't get the free food.
That's a good point.
You know, so you, and over the years, you just developed this odd, well, you're not reacting as well, so you're out. This guy's doing it better, so he sits up front. And yeah, because there were people that had like followings on the LNL video, like, you know, the bald guy with the glasses, he's great.
Yeah, yeah. I'm hoping sometime I might be able to track some of these people down. I'd love to get two or three people saying, hey, I want to just chat with you about your experience and who you like. Anyhow, I think it'd be a good podcast if I can find it.
They probably have fan clubs.
I'm confident they do.
Yeah. No, unfortunately, the festival, I think, just folded because they lost their venue. But there was this, supposedly the largest variety arts festival in the country was in Seattle called Moisture Festival.
Moisture,
because it's held in April and March and April, and it rains.
Okay,
And I mean, we have another arts festival in the fall called Bumbershoot. I don't know. They just said Moisture Festival. I don't know.
But different connotation.
And moist is supposedly the least favorite word in the
Leslie Klein. My daughter-in-law hates that word. She will not use that word in
moist,
her vocabulary.
Yeah. You notice they don't sell cake mixes as moist anymore. That used to be a big thing in the 60s.
Yeah. Moist cake. They don't use that anymore.
They don't. Yeah, no,
what do they say? Just damp cake or?
Well, nobody sells cake mixes. You buy cake. You don't bake cakes anymore. Huh. But,
interesting.
But this it's held in the back of a warehouse in a brewery in Fremont, a small district in Seattle, and it gets people from all over the world to perform at this thing for virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. And Mike Cavney's performed at it, Tina Leonard. I don't think Matt King's been there, but
kind of like Brookledge Follies kind of a thing.
But it has a small but dedicated following. Mm-hmm. And the first time I performed at it, because the theater's like 15 minutes from my house, so it's just a real, real convenient for me to do this. And, you know, you just walked in, and it was like the best audiences in the world. And, you know, the first thing I said after I got off the first time, I go, does anybody ever bomb here? Because I think you could just walk out and say potato 15 times, and that's the greatest potato recital I've ever seen.
Well, what are they getting out of it? Why?
Because it's, because okay, my theory is that it comes off right after it's in you know April, May. It's nobody's working there, and okay. A lot of the performers have just come off the Christmas season at the Spiegelhauses. It was started by many of the Karamazovs. And
brothers, Karamazov.
Yeah,
brothers?
The original
Karamazov. Jugglers. Yeah,
yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I think there's three of them involved in that. Avner the Eccentric is a founder. Tom Noddy is a founder. In fact, Tom Noddy is who got me into the festival because I knew him through a mutual friend.
I'd love to see him. It's been years since I've seen
him. Oh, great. Yeah, he came through and did a lecture for us, and I'm going.
He's still doing bubbles, I guess.
Oh yeah, he didn't do this year's festival because he was still in Germany doing bubbles, he came through doing a lecture and we're going, nobody's going to come to this because nobody knows who this guy is.
Yeah.
And the bunch of the clowns showed up, mm-hmm. but and a couple of magicians, but I was president of the club at the time. So I took him out to dinner and, you know, because we'd known each other in passing for years through mutual friends. And he just said, you need to apply to Moisture Festival. So, you know,
yeah,
I applied because my stuff is offbeat enough that I, yes. you know, I don't. No, they don't want normal.
Were you
acts.
Performing or doing a PowerPoint?
Performing. I did my Da Vinci Code card trick, my Schrodinger's bottles. Mm-hmm. I did coin and bottle there once, really abbreviated because they had to shorten it way down to about half, so I had to kind of speed through it. But I like, you know, I just do these weird esoteric tricks and kind of what one trick sets. Because the one trick set for me is like 8 minutes. I can't.
I love the Da Vinci card trick.
You
talk about the small one, right? With the where they turn it around, or you talk about the large stage illusion.
I have a personal version where I find
the missing piece.
No. I find the identity of a selected card hidden in the Last Supper, a la Dan Brown.
Oh,
it's up on my YouTube channel and. It's just, I had gotten a copy of the Da Vinci Code for free through my book club. And then when I read about the hidden symbiology of the, mm-hmm. Of the Last Supper, I went, oh, come on. If you can see that, you can see anything. And so I just developed this as a one-off for a club meeting, but it went over so well that
I know where you're going with that. I mean, you're looking at things differently. It's
yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm getting a peek inside Payne's mind here. This is excellent.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, all the suits of the playing cards are represented as long as you use Italian suited cards, because you got the bread, you got the staffs, you've got the coins.
Wait a minute. You have Jesus and the 12 disciples. So you got 13 cards, which makes up a suit.
Yeah. Yeah. You have 13 cards because there's 13 disciples. They're gathered in four groups.
Yeah.
So you have one for each suit. Bread is the staff of life, which is clubs. Judas is holding a pouch for of coins. So that's the coins. There are cups on the table. Mm-hmm. And,
wow.
Oh, and the knife. Okay. There's the weird disembodied knife. So that's the spade. And so that's the only suit represented in a strange way. So that's the suit of the card. Mm-hmm. And then there's a huge, V shape in the middle of the painting that's supposed to represent the feminine, but it's also the same as a Roman numeral 5.
Yes.
So the card is the 5 of spades. Huh. So I just go through this whole thing, you know, and I like it because absolutely everything I say is true. I've just come to the completely wrong conclusion. And so, you know, so until Coin and Bottle, that was kind of my signature piece. But now, you know, Coin and Bottle is the trick that I'm really well known for because I did it here at Magic Live.
We kind of lost the track of where we were starting about the Moisture Fest and why you think people reacted over the top.
Right. Like Moisture Fest, you know, like I said, it's just over the years, they cultivated these just great audiences and they're not afraid to talk back. You know, I'll go out and have banters with them, which most audiences, you know, just sort of sit there going, we've paid money for this.
Do you think there's more of that right now? I'm starting to get off on a topic here of ever since Will Smith slapped,
I haven't performed that much since the slap.
You know what I'm talking about?
But I've heard
I think
that
it's broken that fourth wall that people can now feel. The audience can go onto the stage
and that'll be interesting to see. But yeah, I think you know, I personally think that the entire world is just suffering from cabin fever.
Yeah,
we've been locked away
Good
for
point. Don't know
for,
how to act.
Yeah, we don't know how to act anymore, and we have all this pent up aggression and fear that we just don't know what to do with it. And so that's my only Yeah, the only thing I can make sense is, we've all got cabin fever of one form or the other. It's just strange times to live in.
But I just kind of went off on a tangent. Sorry. So going back, you were saying as far as the people just have cultivated really good audiences over the years for the Moisture Fest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bring people in from out of the state, or is it just local?
All over the world?
Oh, the world.
All over the world. Wow, we've got not so much this year because it was difficult getting people
into the back
country.
Of a brewery, you say?
It's a warehouse of a brewery.
So there's only so many people. Could be.
Yeah, well, I think it fits a couple hundred people.
That's not many people. So they could sell out easily.
Oh, they always sell out. Sure. Yeah, they always sell out. And then there's a burlesque segment that's held in another place.
Is it a week-long deal? Or?
It's 4 weeks.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Or 5 weeks. I think it's 4 weeks. And it runs like Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
This sounds like an idea for other breweries to try to help sell their beer.
Oh, yeah. They actually brew special beers for the festival. Uh-huh. But the people owning the brewery are retired. They've been in business for like 35 years. And mm-hmm. So they retired and the building is going to get sold off. And it's going to be really difficult in Seattle to find a place that, you know, would allow you to use your warehouse for 2 months, you know.
Why do you think that is? Just because of the politics?
Well, you have to clear the warehouse out. You know, this warehouse basically just sat empty and unused.
Correct. Yes.
You know, so you need to find somebody. Yes, we just have this whole big warehouse sitting that we never use. And there's not a lot of places like that.
I got you. Now I understand.
So, and they only ran in they would do pantos in the, at Christmas time, some special shows in January, February, and then finish with Moisture Fest. And then you can't use it the rest of the year because there's no air conditioning.
Mm.
So if it gets hot, you'll just broil people to death. Mm-hmm. And then they have a lot of aerialists that they can connect the
like those ribboned
ribbons
things.
And hoops and bars, you know, all sorts of stuff. We have a large circus community in circus school community in Seattle. So a lot of them do that. And then we do get them from all over the world as well.
Seattle and Portland fairly similar in terms of politics and weirdness?
No. No. Weirdness, yes. Actually, Portland prides itself on being a little weirder.
Yeah.
Though the district that we perform in is called Fremont, which used to be really, really weird until a lot of tech companies moved in there. I mean, they have a statue of Lennon in this.
Lennon or?
No, the real
Marx
Lennon.
And Lennon.
And it was only there because after the wall fell, this guy was touring through. And it's this kind of neat kind of Art Deco style. Mm. And he just liked it for the art. And so he saved it and he brought it back. And so, you know, it confuses people. It's just, do you worship Lennon? No, it's just a neat statue.
Yeah.
So that whole area used to be much, much weirder, but mm-hmm. it's calmed down over the years. But yeah, Portland has a reputation of being a very odd city, but highly conservative. I don't know what, for a big city, it has a much larger conservative base than, say, Seattle does.
I would have guessed the opposite.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because Seattle, the conservatives all live on the other side of the lake in Bellevue and Redmond and stuff. That's the more conservative part of the county.
I was going to say about the Renaissance type festivals that you do then as well. Are those in Seattle?
Yeah. The one that my home fair is just outside of Seattle, Incarnation. It's about 45 miles east of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And well, not even that, it's probably 30 miles east of Seattle. And it's this will be my 43rd year there.
Do you have an accent that you...
Yes, I sort of... I'm probably talking in it now. I tend to have a performing voice that I go into that I don't even realize that I'm going into. But I try not to do a heavy accent. I just do an accent just to sort of take the American accent off. And
more
then
English?
Use,
have an English type of accent?
Yeah. I can do it. My lords and ladies, gentles all, pray attend and hearken my words, for here's how you see japes both sly and wondrous to do you ease. Witness before you miracles of rare device, wonder works never before seen, and merriments to bide away the time. It's, you know,
yeah.
So it's more important to sort of change the verbiage than it is the accent. But if you kind of had a southern nasal drawl, which is actually closer to an Elizabethan accent than we'd like to think, you kind of want to. I've always sort of wondered about like the Georgia you know, a Shakespearean festival. Is it to be or not to be? That is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or funny. To take arms against a sea of troubles, to die, to sleep no more. And I'm going, yeah, I just don't think I could watch that.
A little bit goes a long way on that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So as far as your character, why didn't you, with your beard and your general appearance, go with Merlin?
Because the fair that I perform at is not a Renaissance fair. It is a medieval fair, and the guy who the insane man, because anyone who runs a Renaissance fair is insane. I've never met one that was
You work a lot of them?
Not a lot. I've only worked a couple of the big ones, only for a weekend, because I just was in the area. I worked a lot of small regional ones, but likewise, they're all crazy, and they all have their own idea of what the Middle Ages.
I thought they would have all been the same.
No, they all have the peculiar bends. But the guy running this fair, he's trying to make an actual historical reenactment village. I'm going, yeah, that's great. Yeah, of course, there'll be a English village in the middle of Washington. Yeah, no. And one year I had gone to England on a historical reenactment tour, celebrating the 400th anniversary of the Spanish Armada. And then after spending 3 weeks in England, coming back to Camlin and going, yeah, this looks nothing. Nothing like it. Nothing you're doing is right.
I'm sure from people from England who would come over see Renfest, they go, what the heck is this?
And some of them enjoy it, and others are like, why? But so I couldn't do a Merlin character because he's not historical. So I had to do an actual historical character. So I'm a jongleur, a traveling minstrel, which I would have done anyway because I always sort of hate the wizard characters because they weren't wizards. They really weren't. You know, if you're trying to be historical, the historical characters are far more interesting.
You're talking about like street magicians who would be jugglers the type of cups and balls.
They were called jongleurs.
Jongleurs, correct.
It was the third classification and it covered everything from magicians to bear baiters to jugglers.
Bear baiters?
Bear baiters, people that wrestled bears had bears wrestle other animals.
Okay.
Yeah. I just like the term bear baiter.
I never heard that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you don't hear about until you study the Middle Ages. People did that? That's interesting. when I was in the SCA, a lot of people adopt, I'm a noble persona, which means you got to dress nicer and their costumes are more expensive. If you're lower classes, you can get away with a lot more. And you don't have to have the fancy fabric. So I've always been sort of attached to the lower end of society because they're the more interesting people.
There was a magician in Houston, Ralph Markham. And Markham went by Markham the Mountebank.
Yeah.
So he was kind of a rogue and a character.
Yeah, and much more interesting. Then you had, Bill Palmer, who was. Did he actually do Merlin, or was it just a
wizard? He was 25 or 35
yeah,
years.
Yeah, I know he did a wizard character, correct. But I wasn't 100% sure it was Merlin.
Yeah.
But I know he did the pointy hat.
Right.
And then the other problem is, of course, younger, my beard wasn't this long or white. And I've seen guys, pictures of guys in Renaissance fairs in full, tacky Santa Claus beards, and I'm going, yes, and it's 110 out, and you're gluing, you're gluing a dead tribble to your face. No, this is, yeah.
Do you do Santa Claus?
I'm starting to do Santa Claus now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
getting to that age.
Yeah, I'm at that age, and that's kind of my retirement plan is to do Santa. And now that I sort of grew the beard out as kind of a tribute to Eugene when he died, I just started to grow it out more, and then also I just kind of need the length for
Santa. Has anybody, I don't mean to say taken Eugene's place, but as far as filled a gap where he had been teaching before, do you feel like you have been that person to, in a way, not step into his shoes, but at least teach something kind of like what he had been teaching?
Oh,
in
I could never even.
Mystery school?
I could never even attempt to.
Well, nobody can. I'm not trying to say.
I like to think that I'm teaching, but I'm teaching my approach to magic, which is different than Eugene's approach to magic.
Of course, completely. Nobody can teach that.
What I have to say is of value because, Stan keeps having me back every 3 or 4 years and people keep listening and,
we love you.
Oh, that's so kind.
They love me. They really do love me.
and I feel like I finally come to my time because when I first started doing this, I was a big fan of storytelling and theory. I liked magic books that had theory in them. And, you know, when I was growing up, you know, apart from Henny Nelms, which was probably the most influential book I read as a kid, Magic and Showmanship.
Still is for me, too. I recommend that to everyone.
Yeah. Though I hear Teller doesn't like it. So
why?
I don't know.
What?
If I ever meet Teller, why don't you like Henny Nelms? What's wrong with it? Because the thing that Henny Nelms taught me is that for things to be coherent, it has to be a why. There has to be a reason that you're doing. Now, it can be a stupid reason, but there still has to be a reason. If you have we had this magician in our local area who just fancied himself the best, you know, bestest that there was. And he was always advising me on things to do. And I'd never seen him perform before. And I actually write him not by name in my book, because he comes out on stage and he shows a tube empty and he passes his wand through it. And then he shows a flashlight through it. And then he pours water. And I'm just sitting there going, it's empty. For God's sake.
I got the idea.
It's empty. And then he produces a bunch of handkerchiefs from it and then drops them on the chair, sets the tuba down, and then walks across the stage to pick up another set of handkerchiefs to do a trick with. And I'm going, what were those? And I'm like, oh, those are my production handkerchiefs. These are my other tricks. And I'm like, no. This is wrong on so many levels.
I had written something once for a magazine that was a review of a convention, and I remember this guy kept pulling out a bunch of silks, and my review of that was, I'm not going to name this person's name, but he showed us his silk collection.
Yeah.
Essentially, that's all you're doing. It's like, hey, look at this. Look at this one. Here's another one.
I was at a convention where, you know, Dwayne Laughlin did his silk act, which is a nice act.
Very nice act.
But it struck me, if I did this, the stage would open up just littered with silks.
Yeah.
And then you put them all back. You know, mm-hmm. you show a tube and then you stuff 100 handkerchiefs into it and they're gone. Or the funnier one for magicians would be there's a counter on the side of the stage, and every time you produce something, the number is the price goes up. It's $25, $25, $25. Look, it's an 8-foot silk. That's $275.
Now that is funny. There's somebody, listen to that. There'd be a funny act for somebody too. Speaking of Henning and Nelms, my takeaway that I use all the time that I remember is attention to detail is the essence of showmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And I live by that.
Yeah.
I think it's so important.
That is true. There's so many magicians that are just like, oh, that'll do. You know, that's mm-hmm. enough. We don't need to go in. No, I've seen so many presentations that are, you were this close, just this close. If you'd just done a little more, it would have been perfect.
Yes. Right. Right. Going back to something you had said a little bit earlier, though, also having to do with speaking versus performing. When you're performing on stage, you're doing public speaking. But public speaking, when you're performing, is different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully, you have a script for both. But they're two completely different types of scripts.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably different audiences as well.
Yeah. There's generally a different, you know. I have the problem is that whatever I do, it's in the same voice. I even write in my voice. I don't. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who write, you know, have a different, completely different voice when they're writing, and I just can't. I can't change how I think.
Mm-hmm.
But you structure things differently, mainly because when you're performing, you're divided up into a section of small bits. When mm-hmm. you're public speaking, it tends to be a longer arc.
Yeah, that's a good point, because when performance, usually it's like a little chunk or something, and then you can fit these in different places as you change your act around.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, you compartmentalize and you can move them, you know, because you generally, you know, you have a series of openers that you can choose from. You have a series of middle tricks and a series of closers, and you can interchange those, you know, generally.
What about scripting? Do you have recommendations for good books on that? I mean, I know there are a couple out there, Ken Weber and Maximum Entertainment, and others, and Pete McCabe.
I haven't read Pete McCabe's book yet. I tend not to read books on scripting because I'm already pretty good at it.
Good point.
And by the time I get good at
it, you don't want to be influenced.
Well, and I don't want to be influenced. And the fact that when I grew up, there were no books on scripting. That was just, you know, that was mm-hmm. books were simply, these are the tricks you can do. apart from, you know, Henny Nelms, this is how you should do these
and
tricks.
And Fitzky.
Yeah, Fitzky.
Any comments on that trilogy?
The first two are good. The trick brain, I just read it going, this doesn't work at all for me. But then the same way with Guy Hollingsworth, when he came up with his column in Genie or Magic years ago and how he developed his tricks, they're going, oh, yeah, I'm glad that works for you. No, he's an engineer and he just thinks completely differently. Sure. And that's the problem with books on how-to books is that might
don't
work
take
for
them
this.
All verbatim.
Yeah, you have to read all of them and
good point.
Pull out the things that work for you. And like, you know, if you read one and you go, I completely disagree with absolutely everything this book says, and I can tell you why.
Yeah.
You know, and I can tell you why that doesn't work for me. It might work great for other people. And so you can't get this book that says, read this book and you'll master the art of magic and make a gazillion. Yeah. No, you're not. You've got to find what works for you, and it's going to be completely different. You know, and that's what I tried when I wrote my book. I didn't want to, you know, sound preachy, and I just sort of kept saying, this is what I do. This may not work for you, but this is how I approach it, and this works for me, and hopefully maybe you can take something away from this.
I think that's why we go to see so many different lectures. I'd like to think that, at least, is not that we are looking for the Holy Grail, which I think we all are, but of magic, like this is going to make me, but hopefully people are attending lectures to say, okay, I can use that, or I can use this, or something out of this book, or this lecture notes, or whatever, or video or something, rather than redoing that person's act and copying or cloning that person.
Yeah, I think too many magicians simply use it as a shopping, you know, a catalog. I'm going to buy that trick, and I'm not going to change it all. I'm just going to do it the way he did it. I like to go to lectures just to watch other performers perform and maybe pick up an interesting idea here and there. I rarely get tricks out of lectures that I do because my act is pretty set. I don't know. But I like to go to lectures just to listen to the guys talk and see if they have anything, you know, worthwhile to say. And a lot of times this will be the only chance you'll get to see this guy perform live because you're not going to.
Well, that's true too. I mean, like when we've seen Vernon or Slidini or some people who are now classics. I'm so glad to have heard them.
Yeah.
And studied at their feet. I guess quite literally, I've been in front of them to hear their lecture.
Yeah.
Harry Lorraine and so many others. You know.
Yeah. Just, or you know, like when Tom Stoney lectured. You know, you get to see him do stuff that you know he didn't do in his act. You know, so you get to see him do the egg bag. You get to see him do balls and net. You get to see him do all this stuff that you know, he's just really, really good at. But, you know, it's, you know, unless you hired him for a close-up set, you know.
Who are some people lecturing today that you would recommend that people should see or hear?
Oh, geez, make me look bad. I can't. I'm horrible with names.
And Joshua Jay is on the first one that comes to me.
Joshua Jay is always great. Yeah. I mean, his thinking is just impeccable. Mm-hmm. And the way that he structures and puts it together, multiple effects into a single presentation. Mm-hmm. He probably is, you know, one of the greatest minds of our day, since a lot of the old ones are dying off now. Yeah.
Amar has always been.
Michael Amar, yeah. I haven't seen Amar lecture in a long time, but I'm sure he always had really good things to say. I'm just trying to think, because I haven't been to a lecture in a couple of years because
who has?
haven't been any, and I just didn't do any of the Zoom ones. It just doesn't really appeal to me. The magicians that I hold in high regard, I not necessarily see lecture, but Rob Zabrecki.
Oh boy.
And Christopher T. Magician. Christopher T. is a very clever guy. Really clever guy. Really, really very usable stuff, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are some good books, then, that you would recommend?
You would also have to say that, like I said, I'm terrible, terrible, terrible with names. And the best book I read, but I can't even remember the title now. Yeah,
you know who it was that wrote it?
Like I said, terrible with names. It had this really great trick using a handkerchief inside a peach. It was really, really good. I reviewed it in Mum a couple years ago. So look at my old reviews. I it was probably the last book I reviewed because I so seldom get books anymore.
Well, a few books that I've purchased recently was the one by Steve Cohen, Max Malini book, which was really good, as well as the Sawing book by Mike Caveney.
Both of those are on my list. I just haven't gotten them
obviously
yet.
The Giant Thompson two volume thing.
What is the name of the Theseus.
Who?
Theseus.
Theseus.
Yeah. It's an ancient logic problem. And I just bought the book, and it's a whole book just on a single trick and how this guy approached this idea for a card trick and all the different methods he came up with and what's better than others. And it's the idea that Theseus was the warrior who returned triumphant to Greece and so much of a national hero that he was, they kept his ship in the harbor for centuries, and over the years, because of decay and thing, they had to replace absolutely everything mm-hmm. at one time or another on the boat. So the question is it still Theseus's ship, even though
I've heard this.
Is
yes.
no
right.
And so basically what you have is you have a playing card signed, you tear it into four, and you put it in a on the table face down, you tear it into four corners, and you exchange one at a time those corners with corners from another deck of cards. So you've replaced the card with a completely, and so the question remains, is that still your card? And then you turn it over, and yeah, it's still their signed card.
Interesting.
And I'm going,
Theseus?
Yeah, T-H-E-S-U-S.
Is that Vanishing Ink?
I think it's Vanishing Ink.
I think I remember this. Yeah. It's just recent.
And I was sort of intrigued when I read that and went, and it's a good book, you know, and I don't even really do card tricks, but I was really enamored with the plot. It was like Tom Stone's last book, which had a lot of unfinished things that he was working on. And I like looking at things like that so you can sort of see how their mind works and what they're thinking and why this is better than others. Mm-hmm. It's like in the Books of Wonder, the whole Nest of Boxes, which I'm a huge Nest of Boxes junkie. And I love seeing it evolve until it became the final version.
That could be your next PowerPoint.
Yeah, it could be. But it's just when you see somebody say, this is the trick I do, well, you don't see any of the thinking behind it. And why do you do it this way instead of that way? Which is, I think, is far more educational than just saying, here's a trick, it works, go do it.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about the North countries, because you got, you know, Tommy Wonder and Tom Stone who have just brilliant. You know, I guess it's the long, cold winter nights when they're just trapped inside the house with nothing else to do. So I must create, you know, unique magic, and I'm going to be really anal about this and make sure it's absolutely perfect. You know, but those are two of my favorite sets of books are the Books of Wonder and the works of Tom Stone, just because it's just sort of going, these are, you know, just brilliant, brilliant ideas.
Well, in kind of wrapping up, I wanted to go back to the one of the things you mentioned early, and that was working with Jeff McBride and the Mystery School and getting involved with that. What have been some of your experiences or stories from that? Some exciting things that have happened, or people have come through, or students who's like, oh, I'm so proud of this guy, or here was a real issue, or I thought this would never happen, or it's, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if there's something that just comes to mind about your experience with working there.
The best experience, because even though that, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I do not have a spiritual bone in my body.
Okay. So you're not into drumming or any of that.
Oh, no, I have no rhythm.
The fire.
No. That whole aspect of it, I'm going, yeah, no, I'm not. I'm not going to go drive. You know, plus, I'm blind in one eye and don't see very well out of the other one. So going into a big field in the middle of the night and going, yeah, I'm just going to trip and fall into a hole. That's just not my idea of a good time. So I never did any of the drumming things and the spiritual. Spiritualness of it, kind of going, yeah, okay, I'll just put up. But I, you know, I treat it like I'm the guy. I'm standing behind them, going, "You are mortal. You are mortal. You are mortal." I'm the guy that keeps them. You know, I'm the loyal opposition. You know, whenever I see Kenton, you know, really good friend of mine. But you know, my usually, you know, say when I say goodbye to him, says bye Kenton. I hate you and everything you stand for. because we just have this wonderful repartee, because we're just told polar opposites on how we approach magic and things, and I no end of teasing him on it. But even though I am diametrically, you know, opposite of them, they're still my people.
Sure.
I mean, because these are people who think about what they're doing and try to put meaning into the presentations. And this is the problem that people have. They think that putting meaning into magic means, oh, you're going to tell a little story about this. I'm going, well, no, that's not what that means. It's like when Jeff does his Meister's dream, his internal dialogue is that he's sending the child on a spirit walk. Hmm. That doesn't come through at all.
No.
But it's the inner dialogue. And so he's infusing that, at least for him, with meaning, which means that that bleeds out to the audience because they know that there's something there mm-hmm. that's more than just, I'm pulling coins out of thin air.
From the very beginning where he has a child out in the audience and he brings him in as he's banging on the bucket.
Drumming.
Slowly, he's drumming and bringing
them up. Oh, and his inner dialogue is a spirit walk. And so that's the real secret to magic and putting meaning to the magic, is it having meaning to you? Because if it has meaning to you, it means it has value to you. So you just treat it differently.
And the audience
and the audience can subconsciously can pick up on exactly. that and say, well, this, you know, he's obviously interested in this. Perhaps we should watch this as well. Too many magicians just treat it as, oh, this is just a flip thing. I don't, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't, you know, and that's the biggest problem with magic nowadays is the commoditization of magic, that every month, you know, they've hit this like $30 to $40 price point, mm-hmm. and they know that people can afford two or three of these a month, and then they're only going to do them a couple times. You're going to go back into the bottom drawer. Of the drawer,
yeah.
And then they're, you know, we've just developed we've adopted the drug dealers, you know, an analogy for, you know, because it used to be, you know, when we were growing up. You pick up a magic magazine in January and the same year in December, and you flip through them, and they're all the exact same ads.
Good ads.
Because nothing changed. Now you flip through them, and they're from month to month, and they're different ads, and then you never see these tricks ever
Correct.
Come back
There's
on the market again.
There's a new trick that comes out almost every day.
Yeah, every day, and they just got us all hooked and lined up, and I got to buy the new thing,
Right.
Because, you know, they're not selling to professionals.
Feed
they're
the
selling,
dragon.
Yeah, they're selling to the hobbyists. I mean, when the Penguin did their little mini magic conventions. I don't know if you ever went to one of those.
I did, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Penguin Max.
Yeah, and they had several in Seattle, and we just walked in and went, who are all these people?
Yep.
We've never seen
nope.
any of these did people. All... Never at the club, never at any magic
nope.
shows, never.
Right. Don't socialize with,
don't
the,
socialize
rest
with the rest of us.
Conventions or anywhere.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And we would pass out literature. They'd never bother to show up. Anywhere. So that, obviously they're not really interested in magic. They just want tricks for a fix, you know.
Well, and they want to put it on YouTube perhaps and
yeah.
try to get some likes.
Yeah, because, you know, the first one I walked into and there was like a comment section and I went, this is interesting. Not a book in sight.
Yeah.
Because it was all just, you know, all just tricks. And I think that was just right after they acquired a Hermetic Press. And I went, where are all the books?
Yeah.
Nobody wants books. They just want that $20 to $60 price point, you know, miracle of the month. And that's what I've spent the last 10 years reviewing. There's only a handful of stuff that I've reviewed over the last 10, 12 years mm-hmm. that had any staying power. Most of it's just here today, gone tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I mean, I even go through my old reviews going, I have no recollection of ever seeing this.
Well, today, again, we get so many emails daily.
Yeah.
Yeah. Each day of the week, we get something with a new thing saying, hey, watch this video. It's a one-trick video. It's the newest thing, and tomorrow there'll be something else out.
Remember when videotapes came out, and then eventually moved to CDs, mm-hmm. and then the big
DVDs,
yeah, DVDs. The big row about one trick DVDs, yep. and how dare they? Now that's all we'd get.
Correct.
You know, because that's the instructions. Mm-hmm. It's effectively have been removed to just, we have nothing but one trick
DVDs. Well, even
DVDs.
At the Table that Murphy's had done for so many years went by the wayside. And I think that's because, like when I did mine, it was 3.5 hours. And I gave everything. I mean, well, actually, I did have a few things I forgot to put in, but there still are a ton of things. My point being is each of those videos were people's lectures with tons of things. And because it is online, you can watch a little bit now, a little bit later, or whatever, which is like a book. Sometimes you could read that. For an example, like a Richard Bush's book on peak performances. I think Max Maven was saying, I like to read that in chunks. I'll read a little bit tonight, put that aside, read some more tomorrow, because it's a lot to take. His particular book is a lot to take in.
Yeah.
But that kind of a thing, I'm just saying, with videos then now, people are used to short attention span, just getting a little bit of information.
Yeah. Yeah. But the nice thing about a book is you can kind of just flip through it and stop. And you're, you know, DVDs, you're going, where was it? And you have to slough through the whole thing to find the
gold.
The gold. And, Yes. And then there is a factor with all the digital downloads is that, you know, once these companies go out of business, those are all gone.
That's unfortunate, but true. I thought about that about my podcast. I've got 11 years of podcasts with right now almost 700 episodes. And when I'm gone, is this going to go someplace or somebody keep this or will be archived? And how will people be able to listen to voices like yours and mine 50 years from now?
Yeah, well, there's going to be this tremendous void in the art of magic. Because, you know, I several years ago bought some vintage magic from an estate, and the guy had kept all the instructions, so I was able to piece them all together. 50 years from now, people buy it and they're going to have all these tricks and maybe some silver discs, but you're going to have a lot of cards with web addresses that don't exist anymore.
It's like laser discs.
Yeah.
Who's got laser disc player now?
And, you know, and so you're going to have, we have no idea what this thing is, you know, and or how it works because the instructions are forever lost. I mean, you can still read the Book of Kells and that's 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you can read books from the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th and 21st century on magic. They're still in print. The print's not going anywhere, but your digital downloads are just gone.
Yeah.
And then I have this argument. Well, you know, like with library.com. Well, the format will, if it changes, we'll just transfer everything over. Will you? Mm-hmm. And then there's the problem of when we went from VHS tapes to DVDs to Blu-rays, a lot of stuff was lost because they didn't have the rights to issue that on another medium. Mm-hmm. So is that going to happen with electronic books? We don't have the rights to transfer this over because it's a PDF.
Correct.
And now the new thing is this other file format, and we don't have the legal rights. And so we're going to have to find a piece of 75-year-old software to read this PDF file.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So, So nothing is permanent.
How do you transfer an 8-track tape?
Yeah,
for an example,
I'm sure you can find one guy somewhere. But it's like when they built the Vietnam Memorial, they had to go to Russia with the data tapes because they had no equipment that could play these tapes. Yeah. The last piece of hardware in the world that could play these storage tapes was in Russia, so they had to go to Russia to transcribe them. Hmm. Yeah, because you know there's just a lot of stuff that exists out there in mediums that are just gone.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of going, I think we perhaps should kind of wrap up this hour. I thank you very much.
No, this was fun. This was great. Hopefully you'll get something usable out of this. And I tend to ramble a lot.
Which is why I like talking with you.
Because you don't have to do anything. You just sat in a corner and watched me pontificate for an hour and a half.
People often say, I'm tired of listening to Scott. Let me listen to your guests. Just Scott, shut up for a while.
That's probably why I don't have a podcast after an hour. And what do you think of that? You didn't agree? Oh, well, who cares?
Thanks, like, bye.
Bye. And that was Bob the magician.
Yeah, that was Payne's opinion.
Yeah,
that was a Payne's opinion podcast. That would be a good one.
Where he berates his guests for an hour and a half every month.
Well, the way I close my podcast is by asking my guests every time, "What is your magic word?" And I don't mean abracadabra or like Bizarro would say, smapdoodle or something, but. What is your philosophy of life? What do you live by? What is your chi? What's important to you? Gives you reason to get up every day?
Surprise.
I like that. It could be a phrase. It doesn't have to be just a word. I mean, whatever your philosophy is.
It's basically surprise. It's don't make goals for yourself. Just see where life takes you. Because I've never set a goal ever. I got to where I am today by just doing what I do. Eventually, people discovered me. I mean, if I had decided I'm going to perform at Magic Live, well, first I would have pitched a trick. I never would have pitched a PowerPoint. And second, I'm going, how do you do this? All I would have succeeded in would have been to get my magazine subscription, canceled. Yeah. But I got here by not getting here. My philosophy is just, I always take the path of least resistance and I go through life like a cork in a bathtub, but I've just been on the good side of the bathtub for a while. So
stay on the good
side of the bathtub. And enjoy it while you can, because it's not going to last forever, but I'm having a great time so far.
Great. Well, Payne, thank you very much. I appreciate you being my guest.
Yeah. I'm glad to have been here. Thank you.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Master Payne. This is Scotty L. Thank you very much, Payne. I appreciate you being my guest and for taking the time to chat with me before the convention began. We had a wonderful convention, and I want to say as a follow-up, he really did knock it out of the park with his presentation in the general session. He really got a great ovation, and everyone talked about that as I was expecting that they would. So I have also heard him at other conventions. He has spoken to us at the Texas Association of Magicians Convention. So if you guys are looking for somebody also that is a little bit different for your convention, you might think about having Master Payne as one of your talent for performing for your convention. Anyhow, just a little recommendation aside, because he's a great guy, and it's quite different from most you might hear or see. So a lot of stuff we got coming up over the next few weeks. I'm going to be very busy, as I'm going to be bringing you some people from the Las Vegas area who reside out there is kind of my plan. We have some people who are friends there, and I'm going to have a chance to chat with them. I've got someone else who's going to be coming up next week that is going to be a little bit different, who actually is from Chicago. And I am not going to tell you here, but if you subscribe to the Pod Litter, you will find out who that person is going to be. I always like to just tease you a little bit with that. If you'll just subscribe to the Pod, go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and you'll see a pop-up there where you can subscribe to the Pod Letter, and that way you get a weekly update as to who's going to be on that particular week, who's coming up next week, and also some suggestions from the archives. And if you have a chance, by the way, I do want to give one quick pitch, and that is if you are in a financial position where you can perhaps make a donation, or better yet, a pledge of any amount on a monthly basis to this podcast, we greatly appreciate that, and that helps us a lot, particularly since we've had a lot of people who have had to delete their pledges or reduce pledges during the past couple of years. The pandemic has not really been good for any of us, as well as, of course, the stock market and everything else has been down, the supply chain and just things in general. So if you can, great. If you can't, I understand. No problem. Well, anyhow, I, again, want to have you come back from week to week and enjoy this. We got a lot of great things coming up as we are approaching episode number 700. A lot of conventions coming up that I'm going to be attending. If you are thinking about attending some conventions, then also if you'll go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there's a tab there that says Convention Guide, and you will see the ones that are coming up. And I've got a little asterisk by the ones that I will be attending, which will include the IBM as well as FISM and the Abbott's Get Together, Pose Magic Conference, the TAOM, Tricks, and a few others. I'm going to be pretty busy, so you'll be hearing some daily reports from those as I attend as well. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to take the path of least resistance and just go where life takes you. This is Scotty out.